You have to wait, baby doll.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, good evening. Is this Dave?
No, it's not Dave yet. This is Mike Genovino. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, Mike. My name is Pat Boyles.
How are you, Pat?
Very well tonight, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in, you know. And, when I'm not hanging in, I'm hanging out.
Okay.
Go all over. Oh, man. Hey, were we supposed to, I'm from New Jersey.
That's where I'm from. I thought I heard.
Oh my.
Well, I'm in Tennessee now, but I was from Brigantine, New Jersey.
Yeah, sure. My folks had this is a while. They're gone for a while now, but they had retired down in Mace Landing.
Oh yeah.
So I know Brigantine. You know, they've actually done a lot with the island.
Mm-hmm.
In the last several years, you know, there's a lot of money that's gone into it, and it's really, you know, it's a great little spot.
Sorry to interrupt the gossip here, guys. For us to get to work with writing your next book, as you see in the quote from the outline for this seminar, writing's easy. All you got to do is cross out the wrong words. And that comes from Mark Twain, who knew what he was talking about. So, questions, comments, thoughts about your reflections on our initial seminar and the launching of thinking about, perhaps in a different way, your own writing. Thank you for all the responses to those questions that you've sent and the kind words about the first seminar. But let's see what would be helpful to discuss for our group here. Before we launch into the craft of writing, which is what we're going to be talking about in this seminar. Any questions, comments, reflections?
This is Rick.
Rick, hey, welcome.
Hey, thank you. You know, just a comment. I actually just kind of enjoyed myself.
Can you get a little closer to your microphone?
I sure can. How's that?
Yeah, perfect. Way better.
Good.
Do that with
good.
Your comments. Too, you know?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
good.
I was on a speakerphone. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
You know, I really enjoyed making just like a mock book cover. I am not an artist by any means, but doing that assignment for me really gave me the motivation to like, oh my gosh, this could actually be a reality for me. It will be a reality for me. It will be at the end of, you know, so that was exciting for me.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I'll tell you the neuroscience secret behind that, if you're interested.
Sure.
When an output channel is mobilized in the brain, it creates new neuronal networks and pathways to begin rewiring the new information. And the most immediate result is a higher memory retrieval, but repeated findings by a number of investigators show that this kind of effort actually enhances productivity as well as memory. Let me give you a couple of simple and goofy examples. When physician's assistants ask the patients, instead of writing on a card their number or their appointment date, they ask the patients to write it. The no-show decreases 18%. I wanted to reiterate that because there are additional studies that show that simply reading things out loud, we get a better retention than if we, you know, do it silently. So this putting something in an output channel triggers both sides of the brain, emotional and cognitive, and involves a shift of a state of mind for greater synthesis and connection for expression. So this is why you want to begin to write down whatever you're thinking or in some way, dictate it or write it, so that you're beginning that output channel. And don't worry about how it looks or making it perfect or even thinking about if somebody's going to see it, because they're not. This is your initial creative product. You're not even moving it into a draft yet of anything that anybody's going to look at, so you don't even engage that whole left brain function of your editing right. capacity. That's a different part of your brain, a different state of mind, and a different time. So just begin to think about doing it. You know, Julia Cameron talks about it in the artist's way about morning pages. You know, just get up and designate a specific amount of time to write. It doesn't matter what you write. Even if you can't think of anything, you write about not being able to think of anything. So that can be very productive as you begin to think about it. And then we're going to look more at how to shape that and how to form it and plan it as we, and specifically today it's going to be about the craft of writing, so we're going to talk more specifically about that. But thanks, Rick, for mentioning
that. Thank you.
It's helpful. Other thoughts or comments?
This is Kip.
Yeah, hey, Kip, welcome. What's that?
Thank you. Well, I just had to say this. I've never seen a yellow Jeep in my life before this last week, and I saw three of them.
All right, then. Who says they don't make it to the East Coast?
Well,
and if they're only in Texas. Actually, I set some up just to encourage you a little bit, but I'm glad you spotted them. When you code your brain, when you code your radar, you begin to see all kinds of things. That's how beliefs are the software that write our behavior. Our beliefs are the way we code our brain for what's possible. And you guys know this story, and I'm saying it on, you know, during the day of the Boston Marathon. This is the first time since 2012 I haven't joined my daughter in the Boston Marathon. When Dr. Roger Bannister ran the 4-minute mile in 1954, it was impossible. For centuries of recorded time, no one had broken the 4-minute mile, and there were a number of experts who had written about how it was physiologically impossible to do it because it would cause death. And then when he did it in 54, within the next 18 months, a dozen milers also broke the 4-minute mile. And when he crossed the finish line, he collapsed and passed out for just a moment. And when he came to, his understandable question was, am I dead? Because that was the conventional wisdom. So the obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. So a dozen other people did not believe that as an obstacle. So that's exactly what we do internally. That's what we do as mentor coaches, is if there's anything that says you can't do it, you know, what we do in mentor coaching is often to break the script. A script refers to our default mode of expectations of particular experiences. And we listen for the algorithms of patterns of attachment and behavior and emotion in relationships. And our expectations inform those patterns that result in a typical, even stereotypical response to certain situations. So the Jeep is just a simple example of looking at things in a different way, of coding a radar for possibility. Just think, Kip, if you began to code your radar to create immense wealth, you know, stand back.
Well, thanks. Does that mean I have to put you in my will?
Well, only a 10% agent fee is typical.
I figured you were, you know, going to get some kind of a cut. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a quick question, Dave.
Yes, this is?
This is Gayska Velasquez calling from Morro Bay.
Welcome. Hey.
Thank you. I'm not sure what email address we're supposed to be sending the assignments you're asking for?
The one that I sent around the reminder, dkruger@mentorpath.com. I sent around the reminder and the access to the recording where each of them will be in the outline. It was just a reminder of that and a reminder of this teleconference line.
Oh, okay. I guess. Okay. I don't think I do. I guess
okay.
I'll look again.
Okay. Yeah. And if you, well, you can't shoot me an email. It's dkruger, dkruger, @mentorpath.com.
Okay. Thank you.
mentorpath.com. Sure.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions or reflections about what we talked about last time? Well, if not, then I'll move us to lecture mode, and we'll talk about the craft of writing, and then I'll save some time at the end for discussion for any questions or clarifications or things that would be helpful to talk about a bit further. Okay. You learn to do something by doing it, and that's exactly what we're talking about. Writing is no different. You learn to write by producing a certain number of words on a regular basis. You learn to become an author by rewriting. So you're the author of your life story and your written story. So here are some reflections to consider as we talk about the craft of writing. What do you do uniquely well, better than anybody else? Who is your audience? Is this what you want to write about or applications of it? In setting your writing goals, be clear about three things. What your readers need from you, what you want to offer them, and what things you understand that you want to convey to the reader. I'm going to pause for just 1 second. So, to understand your motivation for publishing, I have 12 possibilities and counting, okay? People want to write for a lot of different reasons, and these are some, and just to consider or reflect on where you are. One, to disseminate your knowledge, experience, and message to readers. Two, as a gift to clients. Three, as a premium with some other offer, for example, an ebook as a bonus for subscribing to a newsletter or to sign up for a teleconference. Four, to publish with a traditional house using an agent to establish a national presence as an author. Five, to make money by selling the book yourself. Six, to use your book to make money for other services and products. Now, these are not mutually exclusive, by the way. Seven, to establish yourself as an expert. Eight, to enhance your client base. Nine, as a springboard for seminars, workshops, presentations, retreats. 10, to develop mastermind groups or discussion groups based on your book. 11, to make a difference in people's lives. In our own small way, we want to change the world. This is from Tom Stoppard, one of my favorite playwrights. Words are sacred. They deserve respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little. And 12, to leave a legacy. Here's how the dedication of one such book, A Memoir on Parenting, sounds in the dedication. To Ryan and Lauren, I hope there will be a time when you find at least some of this book interesting, though if I've done a good job of parenting, not revealing anything new. I can't know whether or if it will be tomorrow or a dozen years of tomorrows from now. Know that whenever it is, I will be loving you. May you walk through your days with love remembered and love renewed. Dad. Now, that's from a book that I did called Making Memories. thoughts on parent, reflections on parenting from the heart of a father in the mind of a psychoanalyst. I'll use it as an example later of one publishing option, because we're going to talk about the gamut of the publishing options. Now, another is to think about voice. Definite voice is conversational voice. The writer gives us a sense that we're listening to an empathic storyteller, a kind of skilled raconteur rather than simply looking at words on paper. If you think about it, pick any of your very favorite writers. You could read a paragraph isolated somewhere else and know that that's that person writing, because it's their voice. It's unique. Now, this is different. Developing your voice is different from the simple advice of write the way you talk. Voice involves more than accurate transcription. A true essence of conversation comes from attentive listening and dedicated revision. Transcribing talk is not writing, but it's one technique to help cultivate voice. Some writers speak into recording devices. Guess which one of your favorite authors does that? To let their voices flow and hear themselves at the same time, or that's the way they think. That's the way I think is in conversation to someone else. One step in your editing process, whatever your style is, often this is one of the last steps, is to read your words out loud, because you can't recast a word or sentence that doesn't sound quite right if you read it as it is, so you'll get a better sense of how your reader's going to read it. So it's a final editing. Barbara McClintock awarded a Nobel Prize for her study of gene transposition in corn plants, said she made her discoveries by listening to what the corn told her. She described respecting the life and presence of the corn and, as she put it, letting it come. She said she heard the stories of the plants. She heard them. She learned them. She watched their daily green journeys of growth and came to know the plants in a way a healer or mystic would have known them from the inside, by hearing the inner voices of corn speaking to her as another being. Now, even in previously contributing to the psychoanalytic literature on empathy as a scientific way of listening, it never occurred to me that an ear of corn had much to say. And I suspect if I'd mused out loud to a colleague that some vegetables were talking to me, they'd call the guy in the white coats. For Barbara, though, it was a true exchange. So, from the perspective of voice, consider this short passage. I think you'll hear it immediately. I use this passage, which also fits, pardon me, with my philosophy of coaching, as a preface in the last book I wrote as a psychoanalyst called Integrating Body, Self, and Psychological Self. This is from Anatoly Briard's Intoxicated by My Illness. And hear his unique voice. My ideal doctor, I can imagine entering my condition, looking around it from the inside like an ideal landlord with a tenant, trying to see how he could make the premises more livable. He would look around, holding me by the hand, and he would figure out what it is like to be me. Then he would try to find certain advantages in the situation. He can turn disadvantages into advantages. He would see the genius of my illness. He would mingle his demon with mine. We would wrestle with my fate together like Rupert and Birkin in the library and D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. I would also like a doctor who enjoyed me. I want to be a good story for him, to give him some of my art in exchange for his. So, let's get back to some practical aspects. Design every part of your book. Now, we'll revisit these in just a moment in the book outline, but let's begin. We're beginning broadly here, so let's look at the title. The title, unless you've got something really unusual, five words or less that tells and sells, because that's what titles do. We're going to come back to that. The subtitle. The promise, the benefits described. In other words, when somebody looks at the subtitle, that's the second thing they look at. The benefits the reader will get from reading that book. For example, the subtitle of The Secret Language of Money, How to Make Smarter Financial Decisions and Live a Richer Life. The third is the silver bullet, a clear, sharply focused description of your book that can be recited very briefly. It may be included in a query letter if you go to a traditional publisher. It may be something that you introduce your book to your readers with. It should clearly explain what your book is about, why it's special, and the precise benefits it will provide to readers. Just doing this will be beneficial to you significantly. The fourth is a mission statement. And this is a very succinct 7 to 9 word statement of the purpose of your book. It doesn't have to be a complete sentence. You got to squeeze it into 7 to 9 words. And the back cover. Now, this is ideally written before you write your book. It's a compelling ad copy to illustrate the benefits to the reader. Next, the book introduction. This is the issue or the problem you address for your audience, why you wrote it, its purpose, its benefits, and how you're going to present it. A table of contents and a book outline. Now, even if you don't plan to use an agent, a query letter will be a good exercise. 4 parts, the lead, the body, the bio, and the close. It will help you conceptualize an overview and intended aspect of your book. This is the hard part, to really explain it in a succinct, clear way. So let's look now at the nonfiction book proposal. Now, why is this important? Kip has already asked. Even if you don't plan to submit it to a traditional publishing house, well, the book proposal is the business plan of your book. An architect needs a drawing. A business plan is necessary for business. This is the blueprint of your book. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do, so you should have the end in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take? Alice asked. Where do you want to go? Asked the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. Develop an organizing idea with a substantial center. What's your book about? Why does it exist? You'll communicate both of these notions again and again in various ways throughout your book. The title, the subtitle, the headline sentence, the chapter subtitles all fit a brand, the essence of your book. The nonfiction book proposal is a tool to help you organize and elaborate your concept of the book. Now, the overview, the outline, is in your outline. And notice at the end, there are a couple of references. These are the very two best books, in my view, and in the view of most authors, of all the books on how to write a book proposal. The Larson book and the Herman book. Herman is my agent, by the way. But that's not, that was way, way after he wrote the book proposal. So a good book starts with a good idea. The book's merit should address these primary issues. Why would somebody want to read your book? Who is your target audience? What is your unique hook? Can the hook and the message support an entire book? And what will I be telling my readers that they don't already know? This is all hatching the plan for your book. To think about creating a map of why it's important, why you're the one to write it, pardon me, why it's going to be successful. So let's look at the components of this blueprint, the book outline. One is title and subtitle. The title should contain no more than 5 words. Why, you ask, of course? A longer title requires the reader to think instead of feel. The title should create a motivating visualization, even if the person is not a visual processor. We know that most people think in pictures and learn in a visual way rather than in an auditory or kinesthetic way. So the title should trigger positive images or associations, not negative ones. The focus should also be positive rather than negative, not even the avoidance of a negative. Neuroscience tells us that we get what we focus on, not what we want. The title, in my view, should pass the airplane test. This is my personally devised test that came to me spontaneously when a publisher asked me to write a blurb for the dust jacket of a book. And I said, well, I'll be happy to. You know, what's the title? And he told me. And I said, you know, I'd be happy to write a review or a blurb if it had a different title, but that one doesn't pass the airplane test. And he said, okay, Dave, what's the airplane test? I said, if I'm on an airplane and somebody sees the book I'm reading, I don't want to be embarrassed by the title or feel like I've got to hide it or feel stupid reading it or have somebody wonder if I have the problem that the title promises it's going to fix. Well, he thanked me. He had the author change the title and sent me a nice bound galley to review, and it went on to be hugely successful. I also have a sub-test for titles that pass the economy class test but aren't quite ready for the first class section. An example might be the Madoff Investment Guide. Now, and there are exceptions to everything. Here's one exception of the idea of 5 words or less in a title. It's a bestseller by child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Anthony Wolfe. This is the title. Get out of my life, but first could you drop me and Cheryl off at the mall? It's a book for adolescents, obviously. Two, the overview. A compelling overview of your book, 1 or 2 pages in length, should communicate what your book is about and show the essential worth and marketability of the book, rather than a magazine article or newspaper story. The overview should be a clear, concise statement of these 4 elements. And remember, everything we're talking about, the book proposal, if you submit it to a traditional publisher, and that's only 1 of 9 ways to go that we're going to talk about, this is still useful for you. It's your blueprint. 4 elements. What the book is about, why it should be written, how you're going to write it, and why you're the best person to do it. The third component of the book proposal, markets. You need to look around to see who's going to buy your book, who you're writing it for, why it should exist, your strategy to sell it. And in doing that, you're going to consider and you're going to bump up against 4, the competition. Now, this section tells the results of your research and assessment as to the viability of your specific proposal, the competition, complementary books, and how you're going to support the idea of your unique book. 5, promotion. What you'll do to promote and sell your book. So, this is something, and publishing has changed tremendously. About the only people that will not need to put a specific promotion section in their book proposal, maybe Dr. Phil. And after that, I can't quite think of other people who are nonfiction people who wouldn't need to. So all of us are going to need to think about that. And the reason is that even if you don't go with traditional publishing, you're still going to have to sell it yourself. Even with traditional publishers, they want to see your platform. I just had a book accepted with a publishing house, and that was the first and the third and the fifth thing they looked at was, what was my platform, and what would I be willing to do to promote it? So even if you're publishing it yourself, you're going to have to sell it yourself however you go. So that's important. So you want to develop your platform. So here are some things to think about to help promote and sell your book. So regional and national presentations. And whatever you do, whatever presentation you do, get an email list from it. And whatever you do, blog, newsletter, podcast, whatever you do, be sure that you capture emails. And think about faculty or consultant positions with network promotions, memberships with marketing impact, mail contacts, how you develop that with a blog. You have a way to for people to sign up. When I did a website, after I made a transition to coaching and had a website, a few of you have heard this story, I had, a typical website and at that time a newsletter sign up and a couple of white papers. And I got a very nice response of people who downloaded the white paper, something free, to get my email, and I could send them a newsletter or any notifications of what I did. When I did The Secret Language of Money, McGraw-Hill nudged me in no uncertain terms to do a blog. And I found out that I enjoyed doing it, but what I noticed was in the first 4 months, I got as many subscribers as it took me to get from my newsletter at that time 4.5 years. So a blog can go viral, and we'll talk about how that works. But a blog, if I were going to start coaching tomorrow, if I were going to start with promotion for a book tomorrow, either one, I'd start a blog. That would be the first thing I would do. So you want to think maybe also about collaborative or affiliate partners, maybe different ways that you could be a guest on podcasts or interviews, that sort of thing. Number 6 is the author's background. You want to look at your background and experience as it relates to the book, and that will give you some ideas of various channels for promotion, for marketing, for who you may even want to write to or about. 7, the chapter outline. This is an important section. It's a way of organizing your writing. If you do this first, it will take you about a fourth of the time to do the outline as it will take you to do the entire book, roughly, because the outline is like a one-page summary of every chapter in the book. So by the time you've organized, done the research and organized what you're going to write about and put it into an outline form, you've done a lot of the foundational work of the research and writing for your book. Now, if you send this, pardon me, I did a memorial lap in the neighborhood of a couple of miles since I wasn't running with my daughter in the Boston Marathon, and it was cold, so I have a little congestion. My apologies, and more than you need to know. Number 8 is the sample chapter. This is what you want to begin with. Usually chapter 1, it's simply if you send in a proposal or look at shopping it gets you started. You're launched. If it's to an agent, it proves you can do the job. So you want to engage the reader from the first sentence. Look at some of the nonfiction books in a bookstore, especially the nonfiction bestsellers. Look at the title, because that's what will determine whether you pick it up. The title tells and sells. The next thing you'll look at may be the subtitle, because it tells the benefit. Look at the first chapter. Inevitably, that first chapter will begin with a story. Every book that does well begins with a story. A powerful story engages the reader, captures the essence of the book's message. So the nonfiction book proposal can be anywhere from 20 to 40 or more pages, plus the sample chapter. Now, the book proposal is not just a sales tool for the writer. It's a teaching tool for you, the writer. It's your game plan, your superstructure. It's the planning you do. It serves as a map for you because it requires you to understand the meaning of your book, to articulate what the book is about, and to have a scope, an aerial view of everything you're doing. It's like analogously to the yellow Jeep. Once you view that yellow Jeep, you're going to see all kind of things that you wouldn't see before. You're going to run into vignettes. You're going to read in a different way. You're going to think in a different way. Keep a moleskin or keep something with you where you can write down anything that occurs to you because, you know, chances are you won't remember even though you say you will. So this requires you to think about why you're the person to write it and why people would be interested in it. These are the demands you should place on yourself when you consider writing a book. In fact, the first month or two of creating your book may be about investigating your idea and beginning or writing a good part of your book proposal. So this is the blueprint. Now, let's look at 7 habits of successful writers. 1. Create a specific plan, including your schedule for writing. Stick with it no matter what. Sometimes one of the most important things in life, as well as in writing, is to show up. So all you need is a plan and to stick to it. This schedule is simply a writing plan. It doesn't have to be detailed or onerous. It can look like some version of any of these possibilities. And I'm just giving you these as illustrations because you'll want to make up your own. I will write for 2 hours, 5 days a week between 8 and 10 p.m. I will draft 500 words of writing each day for 5 days a week. I will create 2 chunks a week. We'll come back to that if you're a chunker. I will create an outline of the book by blank. I will create an annotated outline by blank, the date. Focus on a simple, specific action plan, and it can set up the potential for your effectiveness and mastery. And as you know from coaching, divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. Let me give you an example. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything seemed curiously out of focus. I met with him every week. I glanced at the photograph. Finally, toward the end of the year, I mustered the courage to ask him about it. He said, "Look carefully, Dave. What do you see?" Well, I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no aesthetic value, and I had experience and considerable interest in photography at the time. I'd been publishing for... It didn't help. I said, "Steve, the only thing I notice is that there's only one branch of one tree in focus in the entire picture." I thought I was being funny. He nodded. He said, "That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing you can have in focus and see clearly." Which is why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents. And this was a time way before we learn from neuroscience and quantum physics about the power of focus and aligning an internal energy field. Number 2, in the 7 habits, when you write, write. Don't combine writing and editing. Writing and editing are 2 different mindsets, 2 different parts of the brain. You can't do both at the same time, or if you do, it's going to take a lot of energy and you won't be effective because changing from state to state is work. Plan separate times for each. 3, take one step at a time. Have a small, specific, definable goal. Write in small bursts. The first draft may be done at various times, bit by bit, and may be a compilation of several stacks of pages from different times. Here's an illustration of one step at a time. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed, though, to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was asked how he kept going when he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles ahead. His response, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. A beautiful example of do the next best thing, take one step at a time. Now, he knew where the telephone pole, the end of the line was, but all he did was go to the next telephone pole. Four, find your most efficient way of writing and stick to it. Whether it's the computer, writing longhand on a yellow pad, or dictating for transcription, do what fits your learning and creativity style. Also, pay attention to your best time of the day for the creative process of writing, and the time of the day for the most objective work of editing. Pay attention to your biorhythms. In Texas, that sounds like it's easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. So, number five, read your work out loud. As I mentioned, this can be a very effective element in editing, a way of listening on another level. If possible, I think this is immensely helpful. Join a writer's group. Because in most writer's group, there will be someone else who reads the vignette that you bring that evening, and you can't tell them where to pause or where to have the inflection. You hear it as a reader reads it, because you're not, you know, telling them what to do. So this is an additional component. And you have a whole group of people who are interested in writing, and a leader usually who has the wisdom to develop that, and you get all kind of feedback. It can be really stimulating. Six, do adequate research. Effective writers know that good research is about pursuing questions and information themselves, as well as resorting to books, websites, reports, and interviews. One way that I find really useful for new information daily is to have Google Alerts deliver to my mailbox abstracts and links to whatever topic you're interested in. I have over two dozen topics that Google Alerts will deliver to my email. Like an example is behavioral economics, neuroeconomics. If you have more than one word, you put it in quotes. But they will deliver to your email box the list of all published topics, from journal articles to newspaper articles to blogs on that topic. This is how your blog goes viral. Because if you have a little bit of search engine optimization, you know, every time that you have in your title or in your first paragraph, behavioral economics, boom, it's on that email. And there's the title of the article and a link, so you can go to it and see if it's something you want to read. What I do, because I don't, you know, change states to read the article, if it looks promising, I will print it and I will stack up all the articles for once every week or so to go through those articles and dictate anything that occurs to me. And then seven, read the writing of others. We learn by reading. Read what instructs as well as what stimulates. Read from other related fields. Stretch yourself. You'll find your own best balance for reading and writing. Now, couple that, pair that with the top six mistakes successful writers avoid. Avoid passive sentence construction. As you reread and edit your work, convert passive verbs into active language whenever possible. Strive to be clear, specific, simple, and humane. This is from William Zinsser, The Art of Writing. It's kind of the Bible of writing. Significant work goes into keeping it simple and making it look easy. Keep the burden of the clarity of communication. Don't shift it to the reader or listener. You do that by being clear, specific, simple, and humane. Three, show, don't tell your audience. Use stories and metaphors, combining a good story, the right brain, and pointing out the story's lesson, the left brain, engages both sides of the brain for balanced learning. People accept ideas more readily when their minds are in story mode as opposed to a more analytical mindset. So show, don't tell. Melville didn't write a story about whaling. He wrote a unique action and dialogue drama between one guy and one fish. Stories are how we understand and how we make sense in how we remember things. James Watson, the scientist who with Crick discovered DNA, said, you know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. Four, keep the I to a minimum in order to acknowledge and engage your reader. Five, lose jargon and fancy phrases. Hemingway believed that one to two syllable words worked way better than longer ones. So don't try to impress your audience with your intellect or vocabulary or research. Your reader wants a savvy friend who explains things in a down-to-earth way, who also happens to be an expert. Six, be a good storyteller. When you carefully craft a speech or tell a story, the art lies in evoking the desired emotional response from the reader or listener. Rather than expressing yourself or telling what the reader's reaction should be, you enable the reader to have the emotional experience. We can learn from the poets who offer their art to the reader or listener as a doorway to the listener or reader's own experience. One of the storytellers I studied with, mentored with, told him in the beginning of my coaching transition, told him an experience he had going through an airport in Chicago. A woman stopped him, recognized him, stopped him to say how much she enjoyed his presentation and how it had stayed with her for 4 years. And he thanked her and asked her to remind him of what he had talked about. She said, oh, I don't remember what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told. So here's an exercise, chunking exercise. Now, a chunk heretofore is defined as a piece of writing about the size of a newspaper column that looks at a single subject. So it's a vignette. It's a chunk. Exercise one, write a single chunk. Treat the single subject in a complete self-contained way. This might be an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, a description of an event, a complete thought, or even a case study. And, of course, it should be on the subject related to your book. Second exercise, this is not all at one setting, write four more chunks. You're going to see that the chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. Exercise three, fit your chunks into your outline. See what the chunks illuminate or describe to further a section of a specific chapter of your book. The chunk may be simply the collection of a specific story. You don't know where you're going to use it yet, but it sings to you. You know you're going to use it somewhere. Exercise four, plan a month of writing. After you've written five chunks, fitted them into the outline, you may want to revise your outline. After revision, decide what chunks to write next. For these, you'll be more aware of what you want to write and can make a writing schedule. Now, important areas of focus for the serious writer. One, the mission statement of your book. In business, a mission statement is a statement of an organization's primary focus and purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, and its fundamental values. So a personal mission statement can clarify and give meaning to your daily activities. It adds focus and commitment. So consider a mission statement for your book. And a mission statement contains four elements. This is in your outline. Ideals, purpose, strategies, and goals. Ideals are the core values that motivate and guide you. Purpose, what you want to accomplish, the benefits the reader gets that are consistent with the ideals. Strategy. The strategy is simply the art and science of a plan of action. This is how you're going to conceive and craft and deliver your book. Goals, effective goals, you know that. That's some of our bread and butter. SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, time-bound. Create a mission statement for yourself as a writer. It can guide you, remind you what you are meant to do. This can become a compass to guide your story to completion and fulfillment. Write it down. Look at it each time before you begin writing. I'll share mine with you. To inspire and guide people to achieve their unique, most empowered life and business stories. Another area of focus, a business plan for your book, the book proposal. 3, a timetable. Maybe a calendar for completion for each aspect of your book. 4, a daily or at least weekly schedule, specifically. 5, your writing office, the space of your own, as Virginia Woolf emphasized. Your tools, adequate support from your computer to business stationery and cards, books, references, magazine related to your writing. 7, continuing education in writing, in your subject matter, and in marketing. That has to be parallel, too. 8, a writer's group. I've experienced huge leaps forward, as I've mentioned, have come from attending a couple of writer's groups at the University of Iowa. In them, I learned as much from the other participants as I did from the writer who coordinated the groups. And at University of Houston Imprint Series, we did something I've subsequently incorporated into a boot camp for writers that I've done, a telephone group for writers, of hearing someone else read your writing, as I mentioned, because you can't tell the reader how to do it. So let's look finally now, as we close, at your belief systems. We touched on this at the beginning with the Yellow Jeep. If you want to change your life, first change your mind. How do you do an inventory of beliefs that may be limiting or compromising? Analogous to impressionistic painting, each of your experiences is a dab of paint on a pointless canvas. Only when you step back and view the entire picture do you recognize that the points form a pattern of a particular segment of your life and that the segments have their own identity. These are your algorithms. You're seeing evidence of them in terms of how you engage people in attachment patterns, in behavior patterns, in emotional patterns. You create each experience, the patterns and the composite image. Each is at a different level of awareness. You're always free to change your mind, always free to change your beliefs and core assumptions about who and what you are. And look at some of the quotes at the beginning of each of these 4 outlines. They are not accidentally placed to help establish a mindset for consideration for each of these topics. Changing your mind not only alters your brain, but also transforms your life. But first, you have to be aware. Prediction and expectation based on the past create repetition. But when based on the present and future, it creates possibilities. And that's what creates new neuronal networks, activates different parts of your brain. Whenever you go back into a problem or something you already know, it etches it a little bit further, which is why some people get stuck in therapy. Even solving the problem, ostensibly to resolve it and move on, only etches it further because you re-enter it and re-enter the same process. Consider this. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire. And the reason is we always create the outside to match the inside. Now, the secret here is that an obstacle is not there until you create it. It's not something that exists in the world. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Let me tell you an example. There was a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the next frame showed the cat, and the cat was at least as big as the dog and more ferocious looking than the dog, but the dog was safe, was on its leash. And then third frame, suddenly, the leash snapped. The dog looked back horrified, scared to death, ran back, tied a triple knot in the leash, and then strained again at the leash, just let me at him. When you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to write, reflect on the underlying desire. When this is the key, this is the key for you as a writer, and you're certainly free to use this as a nexus in your coaching profession for those of you who are coaching. And that's this. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. Thoughts, questions? How does this seem to you? Are there clarifications about any aspect of it?
Hello, this is Yvonne speaking.
Welcome, hey.
I want to thank you. One of my takeaways are, you know, was really to get into the detail of the plan, the schedule. And I think that really happened tonight with the information that you gave. And then just, you know, how to keep from having those writer's block, you know, to have a writer's block buster. How can I bust the writer's block? So you gave some very good detailed feedback. Thank you so much.
Okay. I'm glad you said that, because there are two aspects of that that I think might be really helpful to consider. One is, you don't need to be motivated to do something. What you need is a plan and stick to it. You know, and some of you and I work with professional athletes and actors. They are not motivated to get up and go to the gym every day, but they do it because they know that's what they have to do in order to know to do what's next. You don't have to be motivated to sit down and write. All you have to do is have a plan and stick to it. How many people have you said, well, I just need to get motivated to exercise or to work out or to get a better diet? You know it's not going to happen, because that's not the way it happens. All you need is a plan, a very specific plan, as we've talked about, and to stick to it. And you sit down and you write. Now, when you sit down and write, if you have writer's block, that is simply a state of mind that does not fit with the creative process. We're going to talk about that next time as we talk about the science of writing. But consider that a simple remedy for a writer's block is to get grounded and centered, to do a brief mindfulness exercise for 2 minutes, to focus on relaxation, on breathing, focus only on your breath, and when your mind wanders, which it will, to move back to focus on your breath so that you get grounded and centered, because it's from that being really centered and grounded, that's where you have access to all of your states of mind, the entire creative and intuitive process. So writer's blocks are something as an indication that you need to get present, and that can be in short order to make optimum use and maximum time for the time you've designated for writing. Does that make sense to you, Yvonne? The unmuted.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay,
great. Yes.
Okay, well, yeah, and thanks for that. Other comments or questions?
This is Kip.
Yeah, Kip.
Yeah, the obstacle that you referenced based on an underlying desire, is that what you mean by a shadow desire that is in competition with or in opposition to a conscious intention?
It could be. It could be. I'm even talking about something simpler when I'm talking about an obstacle, because an obstacle can seem to be sufficient reason not to proceed, but the obstacle, when you think about it in terms of we're creating our own stories, and the principle, and you know from the New Life Story Wellness Coaching, whatever we experience, we either create or accept. And whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. So the obstacle is not there until we create it. If we have habitually created an obstacle and an awareness of that, a mindfulness of that, a self-reflection, can look at what do we create instead? We look at, we get what we focus on. So if you focus on an obstacle, you're done. You're done for the day at least, or for that writing session. But if you use that as to recognize refocusing on what you do want and getting grounded and centered and getting in that creative flow or in that editing space that you have, then you're in business. Now, the surface and shadow story that Kip mentioned is, in essence, that what we know from neuroscience is that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So if our conscious system, the surface story, has the expectable and understandable goal, you know, I want to write a book, I'm going to portion that out into this amount of time this week and being very specific about it. But yet if there's a story that is a shadow story based on an old belief that, you know, some English teacher told you or is a derivative of something from an old story, you know, I don't really believe I can express it in a way. I don't believe I have much to say. If there's a shadow story that goes in the opposite direction, then you're stuck. So that's where you need to scurry to the present, get very present, and inhabit the story that you want to believe. Like the people who ran the 4-minute mile after Sir Roger did. The obstacle of the impossible is no longer constructed. If an obstacle is there, you've constructed it. And there are a lot of things you'll have to navigate. If you have a full-time job or full-time coaching, you know, there's still, you know, a time you can apportion to whatever you want to do. Whatever, I was telling my now adult son, who many years ago this was, you know, the book was dedicated. He said, you know, I'd love to, but I'm not. He said, Dad, you've taught me that whatever we decide to do, whatever's important, you make time for. And I said, damn, I didn't know you were listening. So you create the time for whatever you do. And you don't have to be motivated. You just create the time for it. We're going to pick up right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. And I'll be eager to hear how this kind of marinates after you think about it, after you maybe decide to get started with somebody. Thanks very much, and thanks for all of your feedback and energy. I appreciate it. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you.